Have you ever been to a family event and you've been sitting down on the ground with your child who's crying under the table, and a relative wonders out loud why you're not just being tougher? Maybe you're trying to explain ADHD to a teacher, or maybe your partner just thinks it's all screen time and doesn't even believe in ADHD. Enter A Child's Diagnosis, A Mum's Guide to Support and Helping Others Get It. Now, this guide is here to save you from those endless justifications and give you a break from being the ADHD explainer in every room that you enter. Here's what's inside. How to talk to professionals, because forgetting all of your points and remembering them in the shower later isn't really the vibe that you need in an appointment. How to handle skeptical relatives, being armed with responses that are factual, firm, and just the right amount of smile and nod. Support for your child, because navigating a world built for neurotypicals and Uncle Bob's back in the day speech really just doesn't help. And also practical strategies for school and home that work in real life. This guide isn't just about managing a diagnosis, it's about making sure your child feels seen, supported, and unconditionally loved, whilst you stay calm, or at least look like you're calm. Grab your copy now at adhdmums.com.au. It's far less awkward than telling your mother-in-law to stop calling ADHD a phase. All right, let's get into today's episode. Hello and welcome to the ADHD Mums podcast. I have not done a guest interview in, I reckon, about 3 months. And who best to kick it off than Jen Muir? How are you, Jen?
So good. Yes.
Now, I always like to comment on the arrival. I arrived 10 minutes late, and then Jen has had a bit of a morning.
So funny, because I did this little Insta story post feeling so smug last night. It's like, here are my top threes for like organization and going back to school. And I was talking about visuals for kids, name labels, especially when kids are potentially neurodivergent, and they, you know you're going to lose 15 hats this year. And then my third thing was get a really clear policy around your screens and your tech, right? And I gave some tools, and I was feeling so smug. And then this morning, I wake up at 10 to 6, the fridge is beeping, having an absolute pisses. There is dog shit over every rug. Like, the dogs had diarrhea, but pooed on every hall runner, every rug. Like, not even just one spot, just every single rug. And I just went, okay, that's it. I'm just going to go to the gym, I'm going to get a coffee, and then I'm going to tackle it. And we had to fully divide and conquer to get three out the door, one first day at a new school in year five, the older two, the teenager, just like looking at me like, oh my God, you're wasting out oxygen on planet Earth, Mum, asking me to get a photo. But we did it. Despite the best laid plans, and the plans help, and the organisation and laying everything out the night before totally helped. But my gosh, the spanners that just get thrown in the works when you least expect it, when you least need it.
Yeah, and you've got to be consistent too. That's the thing that gets me. Like, you can intellectually know the visual aids and the screen time, but then if you get, I would never use the word lazy, but if you take your finger off the pulse for 1 second,
feel it.
It's like it all goes
totally
to shit.
Then I think you're going to, and then you redirect. You go, oh, our screens have slipped. Kids are struggling with devices and not following the rules. We need to have a big, quick family meeting. Reignite the, I always have a visual screen policy on the fridge, one for holidays, one for term time, write out the rules, keep it really, really simple. And I have a family meeting and we discuss the rules, and everyone has a chance to like say what works and doesn't work for them, and we can tweak it before it goes, you know, before it comes the rule. So yeah, and we also use tools. I'm using a few things to like lock away devices. We've bought this thing called a brick that turns your phone into a grip. So good.
Have you got one of them? How are they?
So good. It's helping me.
I thought it was a bit of a gimmick. I actually looked at it and didn't buy one. I thought, oh, this is just another thing.
It's good. So it's a really tiny little unit. And so what we do, my husband's really good. He'll just go, Jen, brick your phone, and you tap it against the brick and you feel your phone. And then every time you hit like Instagram, a message just comes up saying this is a distraction. Now, I've used the blocks you can do on your iPhone before, but you're able to go extend for 15 minutes, just a quick scroll, right? Whereas this, I would have to literally get out of bed and go back to the fridge, the walk of shame, to unbrick my phone. And so it has stopped me from scrolling in the night. And I'm going to brick my phone for like that crazy 5 to 7, like dinner, kids' homework, like that period, model it, as well as get theirs bricked for homework time. So, yeah, It's good.
I think having ADHD medication in the body now for 2 years, I started to be able to come through with some of those things that you were talking about earlier, Jen, with, you know, actually having those schedules, being consistent has not been something I've been able to do before. So I like to bring on guests to talk about topics that I feel not qualified and not knowing enough about. A big one that we talk about in our house, my husband and I, is the role of timeouts. I just love Jed's content online. And in the Facebook group, we often talk about parenting and what to do. And I like to stay away from that space because it's still something that I'm really learning about. Really quickly, Jen, a lot of people ask in the Facebook group, does Jen have any neurodivergent experience? She probably is not aware of what we're really going through.
So look, as you know, there's definitely neurodivergency in my family, but I keep kind of the who and the what private because it's my kids' story. I work with, obviously my specialty or what I've really worked into, probably partly because of my own personal background, but also because of what I'm passionate about doing, is big feelings, tricky behavior, the kind of really hard parts of parenting is where I've found myself being passionate about. I'm just drawn to that stuff that some other educators don't want to talk about. And so as a result of that, in addition to my personal experience, what has happened is I've wound up attracting lots of parents of kids that are absolutely going to either be neurodivergent or neurodivergent and we don't know yet, or somewhere in that gray space in between. But let's just say I deal with thousands and thousands of parents and really work with them alongside other professionals. And it's very rare that I get the parent of that really easygoing kid that's just smashing it at everything. It's sort of funny when parents get on a Zoom and they're like, my kid, though, they're that kid where everything is just so much harder in so many ways. And I'm always like, it may surprise you to hear that 99% of the people that come to see me have that kid. So that's probably the best explanation of my experience. But never fear, I have spent about 1,000,000,000 hours on the floor of an OT's office. I have spent 1,000,000,000 hours with speech therapists, with language staff and everything else. So yeah, I've pretty much seen, if not all of it, a lot of it with the parenting of my 4 boys.
It's interesting because when I first started listening to you, and I always like to acknowledge Amy Gerard from Beyond the Chaos, because she was probably the only person in the industry that gave me a little bit of a start in the first 6 months. And one of the reasons I followed you, Jen, was because before you started co-hosting with Amy, I listened to a lot of your parenting episodes with Amy. And to be honest, and I do tend to offend people with my honesty, I actually started listening to it thinking, this woman probably doesn't understand neurodivergent kids. It was a tricky topic. I think it was food, actually. And I thought, oh, she's not going to get it. And usually when I listen to some of those parenting podcasts, I'm always like, well, that kid needs an assessment. They need to see a pediatrician. They need to go to an OT. And I was listening to this long scenario from Amy, and then you're like, well, that child probably needs to see an OT about some sensory issues. I think people can pick up from your books and your content that you're actually quite versed in that area. So we talk a lot about particularly discipline, and we've got that traditional belief. And my husband and I have this conversation a lot where he's more of a traditional person and I'm very soft. If I'm honest, I am the I'm the softest person alive with parenting. I really have to try hard to be more strict. And we have this whole thing around timeouts because particularly one child that I have, I think gets quite angry and I don't think it works. But my husband, to be fair to him, he's like, okay, well, what else should we do? And then we get caught in this thing. So I was wondering, in terms of neurodivergent children, and I know that they're all different, but what are some of the things that are happening in their brain when they're going into timeout or they are removed?
Yes. Okay. So I want to be clear. Timeouts don't work for any kid.
Oh, but shit.
I relate to everything you just said, but timeouts don't work for any child, especially a kid that is under 6, but I would say much older than that. Now, if we add the layer of neurodivergence to that, right, that's that kid that already is struggling more than other kids. They're struggling often from the minute their feet hit the ground to regulate their sensory environment. They are the kid that's had their name called out more times in a park than a kid without neurodivergence. they are a kid for whom they want to go well, but it is so much harder for them. Now, let's pair it back and say timeouts don't work for any kid, because what we're asking a child to do in a timeout is regulate or organize feelings that they've already demonstrated they were not able to regulate or organize. And what we're saying is, and we'll take away the one thing that anchors you, is the connection with us, that safety and that sort of sense that we're with you, that you're lovable even when you're having a hard time. We're going to remove that. So now you're completely out there exposed and vulnerable. And what it's going to do is increase cortisol in your child's brain. So I want to quickly talk about that. So when a child is not going well already, so there's already a behavior problem, our child's not listening, not responding, and that's when we're grasping at either the timeout or the bribe. We're moving for either the stick or the carrot, always. And that's what was done to us. And our instinct is, I have to either do something to punish this behavior and teach my child that's not okay, and that's the timeout, the threat, you know, a punishment, I'll take away something, whatever it is. Or I'm going to bribe, distract, kind of, oh, look over there. If you get down off the table, I'll let you have more TV time, whatever that is, we're going to bribe. Now, those things will work when kids can. So I can just give you a really quick example. I could walk into my kids' rooms this afternoon and I could say, okay, everybody, if you clean up your rooms, you can all have extra screen time or dessert. They will clean their rooms. I can also equally walk in and do a threat. I can walk in and say, if you don't clean up your rooms, there will be no screen time. So that's our threat, which is equivalent to our timeout. Now, they may clean their rooms in that scenario, but I'm not teaching them how to regulate through their emotions. I'm not teaching them how to become intuitive, organized, to build the skills that are involved in being able to clean up in the first place, the organization skills. I'm not doing any of that. So when it comes to a timeout, I get why we do it. And believe me, I've even tried it. And we just know it inflames our kid. But I think particularly with this lens of a child with ADHD who is autistic or anything going on with that stuff where they struggle, it might be a child with anxiety, right? We know that that's going to send them into that place of dysregulation more often and sooner and harder, and they need more help, not less help. So I can't wait to talk about what we can do instead, but I want to be really clear, timeouts don't work for any kid. And, and we'll give an alternative to a timeout that can work today as well.
Okay, cool. I love where your head's at. We won't highlight too much of the problem because then you never get to the strategy. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is my husband thinks that timeouts teach consequences. That is his big thing. How are we teaching? But from what you said, this is not teaching any consequences at all, the timeout.
So here's the biggest problem with this, right? Kids don't want to muck up. Kids want to go well, innately. They genuinely do, right? So if one of my kids hits the other, they're not hitting because they woke up this morning and thought, I know, I want to be the bad kid. I want to get in trouble with mom and dad. I want to get sent to my room. That's my goal for today. What we are often seeing is dysregulation in action. A kid hits because they don't have the skills, the underlying skills to regulate an emotion that has come up and deal with that in a pro-social way, which would be using your words or whatever, asking for help. So if we go with a timeout, we don't teach anything. So what we do is we isolate the child. We say, and I'll give you an example. One of my kids hits the other. I walk in, I say, we do not hit this family. Go to your room. Come out when you can say you're sorry. Think about what you did and tell me why. My child may even be able to come out and tell me that they're sorry and why what they did was wrong, because they already know. Our kids know by 18 months it's not okay to hit. They know. Our kid knows. We've told them enough times. Why are they still hitting? There's a lack in skills, right? And a child with neurodivergence is going to have a bigger gap to fill in building those skills, because there's more going on. They're more deeply feeling. They feel those emotions much bigger and stronger, or they sometimes may even have cumulative stuff like there is a descriptive language delay or something like that that's going to also impact what's happening for that child and their ability to communicate under pressure. So my child will go to their room, they'll come back and say, they're sorry, I can set a timer for 27 minutes. My child's going to hit again. In fact, they're more likely to hit because they feel worse about themselves as a person. I've taken away the connection to me. Cortisol is flooding their body. So now they're less likely to be regulated. Here's an alternative. I walk in, I say, whoa, guys, I see two kids. I see that it's gone wrong here. I cannot let you hit each other. I'm getting between you. I'm going to move you. I'm going to move you over here. My job is to keep you safe, neutral. I'm in charge, I'm leading, it's not gentle, it's firm, right? It's fiercely loving and firm, right?
but it's kind, because the underlying thing behind that is because you're a good kid and you don't want to be hitting. So I'm going to help you out. You're a good kid. You don't want to be standing on the table. I'm going to help you down. I'm not going to stand across the room going, get down. We don't stand on furniture in this house. I'm counting to three. If you don't get down, you're having a timeout. That's not going to work. Cortisol is flooding and I look weak. I look like I'm not able to handle anything. And then that weakness in a highly sensitive child that they perceive in us is even scarier. They're like, my parent doesn't even have the wheel here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's a good point.
So hard to do. But once we realize, and I can't wait to be really practical about how we're firm but kind, but that's the issue. When we're threatening, we look a bit weak. Like if your manager walks into the office and says, if you guys don't do your work today, I'm going to sack you all. Like it's not really conducive to good work.
Yeah, it's interesting. My hubby and I are polar opposites, really. And he's such a great husband. Like honestly, that man, I'm so lucky. So this is not he's opposite to me, so he's bad. It's like, we are opposites, but in a way that we both need to meet in the middle. So we went and saw a parenting psychologist that we see all the time. And initially, it was interesting, before we went and did that, my husband thought that I should try and take charge of the boys the way he does. And just, I wanted to mention it because it was really interesting, because it didn't feel genuine and it wasn't taken seriously and it had no effect, because as you said, it was like hollow. It was like, I'm trying to jump in and take charge, but it just came off really weird. And I was like, this doesn't feel right. Like, this is not my personality.
Yeah, completely. And I'd love to add something, that what we have with how we set limits, right? What we're trying to be is this balance of firm and kind, right? In our boundaries, in our moments where we would consider a timeout, we want to be kind of, how do I show up firm and kind? Now, half of us, we're very good at the firm, right? Which this is your hubby. They're very good at firm. Their instinct is, I've got this because I said so. I'm going to take charge. I've got the wheel when you clearly don't. They're really good at that. But if they do that without empathy and kindness, that firmness comes across as a little bit mean. We reflect back and go, that wasn't kind. It wasn't nice. And a timeout's like that, right? If we think about how to treat a human in general, go to your room and come back when you're calm. Would any of us like to be spoken to like that? Probably not. It's not kind. Like, it's not nice. And then we've got the other half of us, compassionate, empathetic, creative under pressure, willing to like flex and move. Now that's really good for kids too, right? You're bringing this other part to the table that's amazing. If we don't have enough of the firmness with it, like we have to work on what we got to bring up, we're a bit like a jellyfish and our kids are trying to push into the limit and find where the barricades are that keep them safe, and they're not hitting it. And so they have to push harder and harder and harder to find that limit. So our goal within our boundaries is to work out, well, which side am I on? And therefore, what am I gently, compassionately bringing up? And where can I lean into my partner and they can lean into me for those moments I just can't bring that firmness, so they can't bring the kindness? Tap out and use each other. 96% of couples wind up with a person on the opposite side of that continuum. And that is ultimately the best outcome statistically for kids. So the good news is having that balance helps us. And often probably we lean more into that bit. I'm naturally firm. I have to really work on the compassion. I just want to go to your room. That's why I do what I do, because I've had to just rewire everything in me and bring up, I have to stop and find the compassion. Find that sense of, this is just a good kid having a hard time. That works for me. My husband has to ground his body and find his ability to say, my answer's no. That is really hard for him to do, right? I've seen that man stand by a trampoline for 45 minutes trying to get four kids off. Guys, you ready to get off now? How about now? Let's try a boat. Let's try something else. And I stand there going, is that working for you? And he's like, not really.
That is so funny. That is me. I will stand there and I'll just be like, oh, I'll just wait. You know, if they're not ready. It's interesting because my hubby, he's really improved, but this is about a year ago or so. He was a big fan of the ultimatum. So he would say, if you don't eat your dinner, you can't have an ice cream. That was it. Boom. And we call it, you know, they do that rock and water program at school. I don't know if they do that in New South Wales. We talk about being a rock and being water. My husband's fairly rock-like.
Yeah.
And anyway, I said to him later on, he couldn't understand what I thought was the problem with it. And I said to him, you can see one of my kids who is carbon copy of my husband, and they just rock each other all day.
Yeah.
And so you can see him just going, I am never going to eat that dinner now because you've just said that. And I said to my hubby, I said, so if I say to you tonight, if you don't pick up your towel after the shower, I'm not having sex with you. How would you feel? Would you run and pick up your towel? And he goes, no, I'd probably never pick up a towel again. I was like, well, that's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it is. It raises cortisol. So ultimately, especially around food, impulse control, sleep, you have to have a feeling of safety in order to go well in those things. You cannot eat if you don't feel safe. So if we raise cortisol with threats, our kids can't eat. They can't eat. Even if it looks like just defiance, I'm just digging my heels in, you threaten, so on. It's not. It's really just cortisol spikes, dysregulation spikes, because under threat, our fight, flight system kicks in. Now, once that kicks in, no one's hungry.
So if we were to ditch the timeouts, what would we do instead?
In a simple level, we want to do a timing. So every situation that you think could be good for a timeout, you want to do a timing. The biggest message you're giving to your child is, hey, you're not okay, and I know you need someone with you when you're not okay. Now, that might be a very firm, let's just say we're at the dinner table, a kid is just going off, they're dysregulated, they're impacting the rest of the family. Like often there's multiple kids, we've got other needs to consider. Now, we don't want to just sit there and let them kind of impact everybody all night, standing screaming by the table, for example. So we need to do something. And that might be a situation where we might have traditionally said, go to your room and come back when you come. But we know that what we're asking them to do is impossible. So what we might do instead is say, hey, I can see you're not okay. Let's go to your room together. And for some kids and some kids, often neurodivergent kids, but deeply feeling kids that have a really sort of strong shame connection with getting in trouble, they might go away and leave me alone, and they might try to kick us out of the room. You're allowed to leave. You're allowed to stay. There's no wrong or right. The message we're trying to give is, hey, I'm here when you're ready, or I'm going to be as close as I can without leaving you. We're not walking out and kind of leaving them. So really the time in is our alternative. Every time you think time out, just think, you need a time in. Let's go. Let's do it here. I've done time ins on a street in Noosa. I've done time-ins in bedrooms. Bedrooms are great because when sensory needs are spiraling, we want to bring that sense of like space in on our kids. So we get a kid in a shopping center to the car, the back seat, if we can. We get a kid at home into their room because often it's safer. It's soft, like often there's carpet on the floor. It is safer. And we're kind of sitting there. And this is what I'd say. Go to your child that's not okay. Go to them, not away from them. If we could just have that in our head as we watch our child dysregulate up in often in lots of 10, kids dysregulate up by 10 out of 10 meltdown stages, usually when we're doing a timeout. So our kid has hit, they've been really defiant, they're losing it themselves. And that's when we go, that's it, this is not okay, timeout. Because we're snapping, because we are going into fight, flight or freeze, because that behavior they're showing was not safe in our family of origin. We were sent away. We didn't learn how to regulate that emotion better. We learned not to show it. We learned that if we showed it, it got us punished and separated from our parents. So we learned to bottle it down. And so as a result, we may scroll on social media. We may drink. We may avoid our feelings at all costs. We do the best that we can. We see therapists. For our kids, we're trying to do that a little bit better. So what we're saying is this feeling makes sense. You may not hit or disrupt the family any further. We are going to have a time in, and I'm going to be here with you. You may be sitting behind their bedroom door, palms open, going, yep. And you may say very little. Essentially, you're watching a train crash sometimes. You're watching a train crash. You cannot stop it. But you're there going, hey, this is tough, and so I'm going to be with you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I suppose as well that would then, because you've got teenagers, don't you, Jen?
Yeah.
You've got four across all ages. You've got
two teenagers. I have a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old. And so by the time they're that age, look, I still would never go to your room. But you might say, hey, looks like you need a breather. For a teenager, they're going to go to their room and they're going to say, don't come in here. And I think what we need to still let them know is, I'm here when you're ready. I'm not leaving you. I'm going to come back. Something like that, but we probably do respect at a certain age that they may need some space to sort of start processing some stuff on their own. But particularly if kids are, you know, The evidence says under six, a child cannot regulate emotions on their own.
But if you were doing that early, like you're suggesting, I would imagine for a teenager, they would be used to then having that connection time with you when they were feeling dysregulated rather than, like, I would just imagine if you were time-outing a kid for like 10 years, right? And then they...
What do they do in the teenage years?
Yeah, like what do they do? They're not used to coming to you. That's what I was just thinking with your teenagers. You'd have to be seeing the long-term benefits, I would imagine.
Completely. So the single biggest thing that I want as a parent is to know that when my kid makes that mistake at 3 a.m. in a park somewhere at 16 or whatever, and they need help, that they're going to think, I know who to call. Yeah. And further to that, I want the kid that at 30 says, I'm having trouble in my marriage or I'm worried about something, I want to call my mum. I want that. If we time out our kids repeatedly as the ultimate answer to dysregulation or when they're struggling, what they're learning is we don't do that in this relationship. Mm-hmm. And so that's what drives me, as hard as it is to try and stay being the adult and try staying being the one that leads in those situations. And I don't always succeed. And that's what drives me to repair always when I muck it up. So that's the most important thing. You're going to get it wrong a lot, especially with teens. And it's coming back and saying, whoa, I want to get our relationship back on track. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry often about if I did lose it or I did do a timeout or I yelled, coming back and saying particularly, I'm sorry, I bet that made you feel, and you might insert scared or sad. And your kid, I did this the other night with my 8-year-old, and I said, I bet that made you feel sad. And he sort of showed me nut, and I said, scared. And he said, yeah. And I said, I'm really sorry I made you feel scared. Because, you know, I snapped in a way that wasn't even the biggest deal. It was just like, you know, four kids and he was sort of doing something and I just snapped a little bit. It wasn't even a big deal. And he showed me, I'm really upset about it. But I love, that's what we've built, I think, is that he can tell me that made me feel scared. I didn't like it. And we're able to repair from that. But definitely it helps with the teenagers.
Yeah, it's interesting. My hubby definitely had a belief around, he couldn't understand why I thought we should apologize to our kids. It just wasn't in his brain of what he thought that we would ever do. But actually modeling that has been really important in terms of getting them to actually accept responsibility for things.
Yeah. Oh, it teaches our kids how to say sorry. But most of us, I think the more interesting question rather than should we say sorry to our kids, just think about something that happened to you as a kid. And think about how it would feel if your parent rang you and said, hey, I've been thinking about some of the ways I handled some of those things growing up or those needs I missed. And I just want you to know, you know, I didn't know what I know now. And imagine how would any of us feel about that? It would feel good even at 46, right? There's no age. I think at 88, you go, yeah, I need to hear that. I need to hear that from my parent. So if we can do that with our kids, I think it's incredible.
Wow. I'm going to give you a really tricky one. Now, I remember the sibling rivalry episode that we did, right?
Yeah.
And that transformed my children, who I said to you in the time hated each other. And you said, I don't think they hate each other. And I said, I think they do. And we went around. Anyway, I implemented some of the strategies. And if anyone wants to listen, they can go back to that episode. It was really, really good. So I'm going to give you a tricky one because I didn't think you could solve that one, but you did.
Yep. Give me a trick.
This is our biggest tricky one at the moment. We have some chickens. Now, we have the most intense relationship with animals, and I want to be really clear. I don't like animals. I've never had a pet. I have three children who are like Bindi and Robert Irwin. All I do, I go to the toilet and I've got animals' backs coming at me through the door. What would you prefer? What's more venomous? It's just constant. So I've really stepped into this animal place. We've moved on to acreage. It's been great. We have chickens. Now, we have a roster system for the chickens, because everyone wants to do the chickens in the morning and everyone wants to do the chickens in the afternoon. There is some ownership over the chickens. We have six of them. So each child, I've got three kids, I've got two each. Now, my daughter doesn't feel that my youngest boy holds her chicken correctly. So every afternoon we have a physical showdown about who will put the chickens into the chicken barn, regardless of who's on. It becomes a physical screaming. They will fight to the death over these chickens. And it's just a complete mess. It's in so much so that I've just been like sat down on the ground and being like, I just think the chickens have got to go because I just can't stand it anymore with the fighting. So in the moments of last night, I was trying to have a shower and they had a chicken blow up and I was half naked on the grass running around trying to get them to stop physically attacking each other over the chickens. I'm not sure in the afternoons what to do differently because I am just lost on it.
Yeah. Okay. It's a really tough one and I definitely have some ideas. Okay. So first of all, you've got one thing that's going really well. You've got your roster. But I'm wondering if we've sat down as a family and said, okay, the chicken thing, it's not working. And really gone to the underlying worry. So you've got one child, her concern about those chickens not being held right is
correct.
Well, big-hearted worry that those chickens are going to get hurt.
Yes. And she told me that she feels like a mum. She said, I feel responsible. I'm so worried about steaks. And she goes, I find it stressful and they don't do it right. She has to monitor.
Yeah. Yeah. So really understanding her need to monitor and where that's coming from, but then taking charge of that. And we'll get to it in a minute, but it might be that we really talk about this isn't working. So from now on, the person that's on will be the only person that goes out and everybody, the audience in the arena might have to wait inside and we're going to all agree that that's the rule or something like that. But we've got to sit down and kind of go, we've got a problem. And again, I would really highlight it's not working for any of us. It's not working for me. So we really have to talk about that in advance. But we really want to get to the underlying feelings in that prep talk of like, what are we going to do? And then we have to make a plan. It's not just a roster. It's a plan for the problems. We've got a plan for the fact. Now, how, my little sensitive Bindi Irwin, how are you going to hold back from giving feedback and let mum be the one that oversees the holding of the chickens? And we can even put in place, you're going to show mum exactly how I can support the child that doesn't hold the chicken right, but I'm going to be the one that supports her. And you might feel so frustrated and want to take over, but you can't because our rule is we all get a turn at putting the chickens away because we have to do it in a way that's fair. And the only way your sister's going to learn how to care for those chickens properly is with practice. And so you're going to teach me how I help her hold the chickens and we're going to really work on it, but you have to let me be the guide because this isn't working, helping you guys get to fisticuffs. Now, there's a deeper layer to all of this and we talked about it in the last meeting, but you have to understand what you're intervening in and what you're not. And there are often when we really step out of the way of kids and actually get out of it completely, they are able to work out their conflict better than when we're in the middle, right? Except you just said they get to fisticuffs. So we know that we're going to have some core rules. So no hitting or hurting each other, animals, and our damage to property, right, is a really important core rule. And it's really important that whenever that core rule is being broken, you're moving towards your child and you're going, right, that's it. And not as a consequence, but we're going to have to go have a time and you just hit your brother. And even though it was your turn with the chickens, every single time you go to that response, I will consistently come towards you. I will consistently help you with that, contain you until you are regulated again, because we cannot have that behavior, cannot have it in repeat. And so it's about you can't be trying to have a shower when it's chicken time, because you know chicken time is going to be hairy. And so you've done your prep plan, you've got your core rules, and you're like, hey, I'm here to support. And if anybody breaks a core rule, I will be moving towards that person and helping them by moving them away. And a natural consequence of that is you're going to miss chicken time because you will get taken to your room with me and we will calm down because we cannot have a situation where we're hitting each other in front of these beautiful chickens. Does that make sense? What do you think?
Oh, it does. No, it does. I think I've probably let it go too long and now I'm probably avoiding the chickens. Like I'm just like, oh, I can't deal with it. Like my husband and I are both, like we would rather do anything else. Like he'll say, I'll cook dinner and I'll clean up if you go out to those chickens. And I'll go, oh no, I would do that. Plus I'll do the dishwasher if you go.
It's like avoiding a kid with separation anxiety. And yet if we can just get in ahead, we make a plan, yeah. You know, yes, that feels really intensive probably. Like what? I'm going to devote my life to these chickens. You get in really confidently, lead the way with a clear plan and clear groundbreaking rules. If anyone calls anyone a name or is physically violent at all, anywhere to do with the chicken time, that person will go inside with dad or me. That's absolutely nothing. And if you're consistent with that and let them know in advance. And so think about, what is a boundary? It is not me asking my child to do something. It is only a boundary if I am telling you what I will be doing.
I've had the family meeting establish rules. I've printed them out, put them on the fridge.
Yep.
But have I actually implemented rules in the moment and gone out there with them? I think probably what you said was a major part I've missed, I can see now, is sitting down with my daughter and being like, tell me all of the steps of this chicken care that needs to happen.
And then,
and then getting me to actually, and I find this quite painful because it's so finicky, but she's so intense with them. And then actually making sure that all of that's happened and then getting her to trust me.
Her helping you to educate the other children on the importance of it. And so before that child that struggles to hold the chickens correctly goes to hold the chickens, I know you're so excited, it's your turn today, but remember, how are we going to hold the chicken? Let's have a quick talk about it. We're going to hold the chicken exactly the way Bindi Irwin has taught us to do it, because that's the best way for the chicken. The other thing in your prep plan, yes, it's what the rules are, but it's also what I will do if you struggle. I know you guys struggle because you feel so strongly about these chickens. I get it. You all have a strong belief about the way this should be done. And that makes sense. But we can't have the fighting around the chickens. So what I will do is, if anyone is getting too worked up around the chickens, I will be helping you step away to calm down. And that's got to be on your plan, so you know what you're doing in the moment as well. I reckon you do that for 36 hours, you will not have a problem with those chickens.
Okay, so I'll have to get hubby on standby because that will be a two-person job. I'm going to take Bindi Irwin out because she's going to be the one that's going to have to get out.
And if Irwin's our problem, we need to really sit down with Bindi and understand why she feels so passionately, why it's so hard, what can we do? What would help her to feel confident we've got this in supporting the other kids with the picking up of the chickens? What do we need to know? How can she help us? Let's get her on our team.
Yeah, I reckon the part that we've missed is that getting this intense system that she has on paper and then trusting me or my husband to oversee it. Yeah. Because I actually think there's a part of her that she said she's very tired. She's exhausted with it, right? She's actually over it. But she's got this stress that it's not going to be done right and a snake is going to get in there. And that drives her out of fear to go out there still. But I actually think if she thought that I had it or my husband had it, she would actually probably sit and watch TV and have a few days off.
Yeah. And interestingly, you said at the start, I don't like animals. Like, I've succumbed to my kids. Well, she knows that. So if you said to her, you know what, I've thought about this. I haven't really backed you up with this thing that you're really worried about, and you're worried about it for a really good reason. Her worry is really beautiful, right? And so I'm going to take this on really seriously and support you with this. So I think that would make a difference too. So it's always about the connection, the understanding, particularly with the child that's struggling. It's always going to start there. Nothing's going to improve. We're going to be hitting our head against a brick wall unless we get into that. But then it's about our consistency, being really clear when those core rules are being broken around the chickens, that without fail, I won't turn away and just leave them to it. I will walk to them. And then at the same time, leaving them to sort out the lower level stuff. So when they are kind of having kids will, because they're meant to do this, they're fighting over this thing, it's part of development. We're not in the middle of everything. But we're very clear and upfront that once we're off track and we're breaking those core rules, I will be stepping in consistently and I will, you know, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah, I love that. I reckon you're right, though. I don't think it would take months of me going out there. And to be fair, my husband's really good at this stuff. Like, he's really firm but fair.
Maybe he needs to be put on chickens for 3 days. I reckon you'd have it sorted.
I reckon I'll have to pay him back with some cooking or something and he will be down. I'll have to send you an email in about a week's time and be like, the chickens have now settled down. Thank you. That was a tricky one. Now I just give you tricky ones. So what if a child's behavior is aggressive? So we've spoken about the hitting, kicking and throwing things. How do we step in and set a firm boundary without isolating them?
Yeah. Look, it's really, really hard. And some kids can get really aggressive. And what we have to remember is a child that's getting really aggressive is so terrified. It feels so horrible within their body that anything that isolates or, you know, in the old days, smacking, right, is going to just make everything so much worse. But however, when a child is that dysregulated that they're hitting, kicking, hurting things, hurting people, throwing property, it is so important that A, consistently every single time we go towards our child, you're getting lower, but you are so in charge. It is so important that you're kind of predicting the next hit and you are ready to be bigger and stronger. And this is the most important thing. It's physically like, oh, can't let you hit. You can be mad, but you may not hit. It's kind of how it might look, which is, it's not gentle. Like that whole gentle parenting thing that has misled a generation of parents in that my child's hitting me in the face and I sat there, please, darling, that hurts, mummy. It's just
hands it for hugging.
Yeah. Right? It's so wishy-washy. It's so terrifying for kids because they're like, I am out of control and you are looking like you're just going to let me. And that's really scary. So they absolutely need you to stop them. Now, many parents will say to me, you don't understand how big my 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 7-year-old is. I've worked with families where we've got a 7-year-old throwing glassware at parents' faces, right?
Wow. Okay.
And I would still say, and I get like, you know, honestly, I get results like within a week that behavior stops when parents start stopping their child. You don't ever want to just let a child throw chairs or glasses or as little kids just hitting you, right? Stop them. It's so much kinder because kids don't want to be hitting or throwing and their bodies are doing that to seek the help. They're saying, stop me, help me, contain me. So in some cases, what we're doing to physically keep a child safe is that big bear hug around them. We're going to physically restrain them and they might be thrashing against you. You know, stop it, you're hurting me, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as if you're skinning them alive and you're like, I'm just bear hugging you, but okay.
And what you're really doing is regulating yourself, but staying in charge. Hey, I got to keep you safe. And you may not say anything else. Don't try and tell them to take deep breaths. Don't try and do anything. That train is still crashing. But until our child knows, hey, I've got you, they can't go over the crest and then down. They're going to burst into tears, right? They're going to burst into tears. We just got to get them over that crest. So it's kind of about watching the crest and knowing when they've come over the other side. And one of the analogies I give to parents, one of them is imagine the little baby that's going, help, I'm freaking out. And we swaddle them up, we hold them tight, and we shush and we pat them, and we just co-regulate them instinctively, right? We don't say, oh, maybe he wants his freedom. We just wrap the baby, right? We're doing the same with a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old or even an 8-year-old that's still struggling to regulate. And ideally we catch those cues and we do it earlier, but it's always going to happen that kids will flip out. They're meant to flip out, but once they're hitting or hurting or serious name calling, I'm stepping in, hey, that can't happen in our family. I'm here to help. But it's always, I'm here. I can see you're not okay. So all I'm ever asking is my kid okay or not okay? If my kid is not okay and they're really not okay because they're breaking core rules, they need me. And so I'm going to them. And that is going to look so different every time, right? But we definitely don't want to be moving away from them, you know, within reason. If a child is kicking me and I have no way of containing that leg, I'm like, oh, I'm going to stand up to keep me safe. I'm right here. I can see you're not okay. I'm still helping you. I'm still leading you out of this. Or leading you kind of with you in this.
My youngest boy, he's the most beautiful boy. I call him like the Joker. He finds everything hilarious and he is very sensory seeking. He doesn't have enough sensory input and all day, every day, he wants to hit. So when it's with me, he's quite playful. It's like a tap, like he's tapping my leg. It's annoying, but it's not, I wouldn't call it hitting. I would call it tapping, right? He'll tap my leg, he'll tap my arm. He's always rubbing me. He's very sensory seeking. He loves a hug. He's always on you. But with my husband, he will just fully unleash the hitting. I thought for a while it was that he wanted attention and it's probably, well, it's not probably, it is definitely more hitting, punching. He does love a punch to the balls. He's very well known for that. We had a psychologist came over and the guy said, oh, hello, how are you? And he just punched him in the balls. He is a hitter, but he won't hit other children. He just likes to hit my husband. We've tried distracting and it doesn't seem to work. I was wondering if you had any ideas there because it is tricky because my husband gets angry, rightly so, because he's just over it. And then he's dysregulated and then he's probably, to be fair, kind of unhelpful because he's had a half an hour of hitting and he's over it.
The thing that I'm hearing, both of those stories, it's not working for either of you. And parents, right, that's the most important thing. One of the things you said, and it's a key word for me, you said it's annoying. I want to really quickly finish by talking about something called the emotional climb, okay, because it's so important. It's going to make a lot of sense to you. So what, you know, your kid is doing with the punch to the balls or the hitting of your husband or even the tapping of you is not working for you. The first thing we have to kind of think about in terms of what's a boundary, what's not, when something in our head as a parent is not working for us, that's the first sign that a boundary needs to be set and our kid is on an emotional climb. An emotional climb is a really interesting thing. We can know that kids show up to 10 lower level emotions that let us know, hey, I'm dysregulating here and I need your help. So they will start with tapping, joking around. They will start with something that annoys you, but it's not necessarily wrong. They might be silly and not listening, but not necessarily doing the wrong thing particularly.
Yeah, this is him. This is, I can see this. Yes, this is him every day. Yes.
That's a one, a two, a three. You're annoyed and you start to get a bit tense in your body as well as that annoyance and you get that walking on eggshells feeling, yeah, I know where I'm heading, right? Your body knows before your brain cognitively knows, my kid is not okay. My kid is actually saying, help me, stop me, co-regulate with me or set a boundary so that I can push against it, have a cry and release that pressure that is building. Now, if we ignore it, our kids at a five, now they're standing on a table, they're looking at us in the eye and we're saying, get down, and they're going, what you going to do about it? They're now
passing every afternoon. Yes. Yes.
They're now punching a stranger in the balls. They're picking on a sibling. They're throwing food, whatever, right? We're up here.
Yes.
They're
pulling
hair. We might try to distract at that point, but our child is already tipped over to where now we're on a climb right up to where our kid potentially will hit a 10 out of 10 and they will go into full flight, fight or freeze. They're fully going to lose it. And sometimes kids are going to do this climb irrespective. But if we can get really good, and I'll talk about you first and your husband, at noticing that lower level build into that climb and just going, you know what? I don't like being tapped. I'm allowed to say to my kid, love you to the moon and back. You can go tap something else. You can go punch the punching bag outside, but you may not tap me. I don't like it. And there is something so kind in that because what you're actually doing is saying, hey, I see you. I'm not ignoring it. I know you're not okay. And I'm here to step in. Let's do this. In fact, I'd say, let's do this fully. Let's think about where it hits a five or a six out of 10. Our kid asks for ice cream for dinner and you say no. And they're at the freezer going, I'm just going to open the door and get it. So I know where they are. Right?
Yes.
Kid again is saying, stop me. I truly believe it. We step in, we get between our child and the freezer and go, I'm not letting you have an ice cream. I can see you're having a hard time. And with your husband, because that's at a five or a six, if he's genuinely hitting him, predict that hit. Notice that dysregulation. Notice that climb. And know, I know this time of day, he's likely to walk. If he comes near me, I'm going to predict that hit. Get down low and go, hey, I can see you might need a big squeeze. I'm not going to let you hit me, just so you know. If you need to hit me, let me know and I'll stop you. But we're trying to get aware of that and see our kid. Once they really cap over that, if we've let them push past us to the freezer and now we're going, that's it, I'm throwing all the ice creams in the freezer and we're never going to have ice creams ever again in our lives and you can go to your room and now we've lost it. But what we want to do is try to stay with our child. If they cap over and they're at the 10 out of 10, then we're going, hey, you're not okay. We're going to go have a time in. We're literally just trying to get our child back to a place of safety. But the reason why the tapping is interesting, and that's why he's doing it to you because you're probably the more primary caregiver in some of those times, he's saying, I've had this really hard day at school. My body is feeling really, really antsy. I'm like, all this stuff is going on at a sensory level and I'm letting you know I'm not okay. And that's your cue some of the time to go, hey, I can see you're not okay because you're tapping me and you're not like it. So we're going to go outside and do some wheelbarrow races.
Oh, yeah. We've got these Mai Tai gloves. I probably just missed the part where I get in there.
We missed the climb because we weren't taught how to spot that. Mm-hmm. We don't spot the climb in ourselves because we were sent to our rooms and our parents missed it. And so, you know, we don't spot it in our kids because at a like underneath level, your body is going, can tell my kid is not okay. And something about that is not okay for us. Because underneath that tapping, it's an emotion and it's dysregulation that's building. So when our kids are annoying us, they're on a pathway to dysregulation. First sign.
But you're right, though, because when he starts doing that, he doesn't actually resettle. It is a pathway up. And you're right, I do see it coming, but I think it's a lack of knowing what to do.
I actually have those things there. I just don't put it together at the right time.
But spotting the climb and going, whoa, he's at a two. I reckon he's at a two or a three. There's so much I can do at a two or a three. His brain's still online. Like six, seven, eight, there's nothing you can say. We can't teach. We can emotion coach later. But once we've lost our kid, we just have to get the system back to safety. But at a two or a three in any kid, we have an opportunity there. We can name the underlying feeling. I can see your body is just feeling done. It has been a huge day at preschool or school, right, buddy? So empathy goes a long way. Naming what's happening in the body goes a long way. Helping him with those strategies. Let's have a drink of water. Let's have a big squeeze. Let's get you outside. I'm spotting that climb. It will not stop them every time. You may have a child that's like, no, I got to go there. Because the meltdown's the discharge. It's the dog shaking. And a kid who's neurodivergent has to have more meltdowns. There's more to discharge. They're deeper feeling. So there's more. It's got to go. Sometimes you're
becoming. Thank you so much, Jen. That was my two most tricky parenting challenges at the moment. And our parenting psychologist has been away for like 8 weeks. How dare he? So that was so quick and so valuable. I so appreciate that. And I'll send you an email and let you know how I go. If anyone's listening, they love the sound of Jen, please check out the show notes. I'm going to put the sibling rivalry episode. That was like a year ago, so it's probably, way down in everybody's list. So I'll put the episode link in there. Jen has got an amazing book. What is the name of your book, Jen?
My book is called Little People, Big Feelings, and it does cover all this stuff. I also have a course called Smoother Siblings in 7 Days. I've broken down sibling content over 7 days because I think we learn better over those days, and it just gives you one 7-minute video and one printout that you apply each day. And over that 7 days, you really get a handle on what's really happening underneath sibling dynamics, which, as we've discussed in that episode, it's not what it looks like. It's not your kid hates the other kid. It's all about us and getting to the underneath of that and how we respond.
That's great. You know, one of the things that stops me from doing online courses is like, I don't have time. So did you just say it was one 7-minute video and then one worksheet a day and that's it?
Yeah.
I could probably do that.
I'm moving all my content away from like 1.5-hour webinars, and also because we know more than we ever knew. But what we're really doing is shifting our perspective. We're shifting an old idea, and we do that better when we break that stuff up. 7 minutes, 7 days.
Wow. Yeah, because I would have listened to your sibling rivalry course and then I would have gone, oh, I don't have time for that. It would be too long. But actually, the 7-minute video is great.
Yeah. So it breaks it up. So day one, you're just setting your core rules. And day two, you're starting to understand with your protagonist what's really going on. So with your chicken lover, we get to that child and we sort of start to work on that and get the empathy going. And then day three, we do something else. So it sort of works like that. And it builds up to sort of breaking up BIFOs and all those kind of things.
Great. Okay. So we've got the book, we've got the course, and of course, we've got Beyond the Chaos, the podcast as well.
Yeah.
What I love about Beyond the Chaos is Amy Gerard, who I just love, gives all kinds of scenarios, which are always highly relatable and hilarious. And then Jen breaks them down. And Amy, I love the way that she just says what everybody's thinking, particularly around one of those food episodes when you were doing some suggestions and then Amy was like, so I'm cooking food that my kids will never eat. She said blatantly, flat, blunt, straight in there. And I was like, that's exactly what I was thinking. So if anyone would like to just do a bit of a taster on Jen, Beyond the Chaos is a great podcast as well. I really have to thank you for your time, Jen. I know you're really busy. I love what you do and I love your content. It really aligns with what ADHD Mums is about, which is taking care of the mum and giving bite-sized strategies because, we just don't have the time.
Parents are sinking.
They are. So I really appreciate some really practical, relatable and quick strategies that will work. So thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me. Let's do it again.
Thanks, Jen.
Bye.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.